Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Jordan Williams, and this is an appeal from a conviction in Superior Court. And the issue before the Court is a search and seizure question. This is not the first oral argument in the case. My colleague, Mr. Robert Robertson, has presented argument to the Court on two occasions before. I know that the Court exhaustively questioned Mr. Robinson, counsel for the state, in prior arguments, and I don't intend to retread that ground. When the Court has questions concerning anything addressed to that, I'll address that, but I intend to address the questions that the Court raised since the last argument en banc. Four specific questions, and I'm going to address those this morning or this afternoon. The first question of the court raised and asked the parties to address was whether Section 1902 of the Code reflected a public policy determination by the General Assembly that police officers should only initiate non-arrest contact with the public if the criteria of the statute are met. In that regard, does Section 1902 preempt any common law governing police stops? The short answer to the question is yes. However, some background is necessary to fully answer the question. I tried to cover everything in the supplemental memoranda. I'll just summarize it here now. At the time, a frequent misunderstanding of ourselves as lawyers, I think as prosecutors or as defense counsel, is that the United States Supreme Court and its decisions under the Fourth Amendment under Section 1902 have dictated or directed what police officers may always do insofar as infringement of a citizen's liberty based upon probable cause or based upon reasonable suspicion in investigatory stop situations.
That's Mr. Law, before you proceed with 1902, since you said the answer is yes, just it would be helpful to me to know how that relates to what a police officer should do if there's a motorist on the shoulder of the road with a flat tire. If the answer to 1902, as you say, is yes, are we going to have police officers just drive by motorists with flat tires? And if they stop to help the motorist with the flat tire, how can they do that if 1902 is controlling?
They can do that because there's been no seizure under those circumstances. I don't believe that there's been a seizure under the common law. There's not a seizure for purposes of Section 1902, the investigatory detention statute. Under those circumstances, I think some of the Superior Court decisions and other court decisions, I would approach it from a different premise. They say that, well, there's a caretaker function here. In the majority of those cases, we don't even get to that because there hasn't been a seizure. When a police officer stops, you need help, you want me to call roadside assistance for you, get a tow truck out here, that's not a seizure, primarily because there hasn't been a seizure because the person that the police officer is talking with isn't going anywhere, and the police officer hasn't held him up. So, yeah, the Superior Court cases where a person is unconscious behind the wheel on the shoulder of the road, and the police officer pulls over, taps on the window, are you okay? Well, in those cases, we don't even get to the caretaker or emergency function because there's been no seizure. And an interesting case, the state brings up an interesting case in that regard, in its supplemental memoranda, the Buckingham case. In Buckingham, it was a robbery of an armed robbery and shooting at a Millsboro supermarket. And in that case, the original police officer on the scene was not there for the robbery, but pulled into the parking lot, the rear of the parking lot, and saw a vehicle with lights flashing. And a woman was apparently outside the car, inside the car. And he approached and said, "Do you need help?" And so that is, there's no seizure, first of all, and it's also the community caretaker function. No problem whatsoever there. What happened, however, while she was explaining why she couldn't get the car started, or there was a problem with the car, and he was either not seizing or exercising community caretaker function, however we want to describe it, another person, a male, came running out from the direction of the supermarket around the corner, and when he saw the police officer, his hands went up in the air. police officer, I guess, thought that was kind of puzzling and then realized the woman is having trouble starting, is not really having trouble starting this car. And puts two and two together, the reaction of the individual who's the associate with people, the police officer asks for identification. Says under those circumstances, two people don't have it, says the woman does, her identification doesn't check out. Meanwhile, an ambulance comes by and said, are you here for the robbery and shooting in the supermarket? At that time, says that detention, there's no problem. It initially started out as a community caretaker function and there was no seizure. But by the time that there was a seizure, the police officer in Buckingham required, says, identification. The police officer had reasonable and articulable suspicion to believe that a crime was afoot, and there was no problem, says, whatsoever in that case.
You started off with 1902 by saying that it had an effect on the common law. Can we start with step one? What was the common law of Delaware, making the assumption that we understand what federal constitutional law is here and putting it on a shelf somewhere? What was Delaware's position at common law before the General Assembly adopted 1902 on the circumstances under which a police officer could stop someone, arguably seize them or not, and ask them questions 1, 2, 3, 4, or any combination thereof?
Yes, we believe it is clear that under Delaware's law, investigatory stops were not permitted. Investigatory seizures of Delaware citizens were not permitted unless there was probable cause for the seizure.
And Rickards. Rickards case.
Yes, sir. And Rickards, Rickards illustrates that.
So 1902 then was passed by the General Assembly to lower the standards so police officers could ask four investigatory questions specified in 1902 when they had a reasonable articulable suspicion to believe the crime had been committed, was being committed, or was about to be committed.
Yes, sir. And I believe it's not a coincidence that that statute has passed 6 months after, says Rickards. And as the state points out, as the defense points out, there was discussion, progressive discussion, in preceding years about how modern developments insofar as communications, transportation, and whatnot, the police officers, the function had changed, somewhat given the mobility of the population, et cetera. And there was a need for permitting police to have limited powers to conduct investigatory stops, and that the Interstate Commission on the Interstate Commission on Uniform Crimes adopted the Uniform Arrest Act as a model. Professor Warner commented upon that in the Virginia Law Review, his article in 1942, and then. Almost 10 years later, says Delaware essentially has adopted that standard and permitted investigatory stops where there was reasonable and articulable suspicion for the police officer to believe that a crime was being committed and to permit the police officer to freeze the situation and conduct a temporary, says detention, of limited duration. And that, so what Terry did, several years after that, Terry addressed the situation, similar situations in Ohio and also in the companion cases in New York, where the investigatory stops were permitted under state law. The question was whether it offended the Fourth Amendment. So, and Terry has ruled that these investigatory detentions under state law, the facts, in those cases, under state law, were not violative of the Fourth Amendment standards. They didn't go below the floor, as of what the Fourth Amendment says required. However, it's still a situation whereby the infringement of liberty must be permitted under state law to begin with. It must both be permitted under state law and not forbidden under the Fourth Amendment. And what Rickards makes clear is that states, Delaware, and even there was an extensive discussion this in Sebron versus New York, the companion case to Terry, how explained, there was a passage in that explained how the court wasn't ruling that police officers could always do certain things under factual circumstances, the court was reviewing whether what was permitted under state law was permissible under the Fourth Amendment. So in that case, 1902 modified what was the common law of Delaware beforehand. And in that, and as to the second question, I guess I addressed the second question, the extent that time permits, relate the history of the Uniform Arrest Act and describe that history as relevant to the factual circumstances in this case. The what we're contending here is that at trial, the defense did not dispute that there was a violation of 1902 or a violation of Delaware law as a result of the police officer's inquiry of her client concerning, are you cold, you need a ride, something like that, is everything okay? That's okay. There wasn't any seizure under those circumstances. But our contention is that when the police officer went beyond that to inquire of the defendant, what's your name, what's your birthday, those two questions, the police officer exceeded the scope of what was permissible previously in that it was not a detention and that, or the police officer was fulfilling a community caretaker function.
Well, now, there was if there's a sort of a booking exception, administrative booking exception, if someone's arrested, why isn't it reasonable if you are going to give community care to someone to be able to make a record as to who you gave the care to, assuming that doctrine is adopted? So what's wrong with administratively finding out what someone's name is so that you can make a record? Or if someone's even in more dire circumstances so that you can contact family to find out if there's blood type, medical issues, that type of thing.
The problem with that is that, you know, we'd argue on the facts that it was pretextual because it was obvious under these facts what the police officer was after. He asked name and birth date for a specific purpose. He said, what did you do afterwards? Well, I did what I usually do. I ran a 1029 check, a warrant check. So this bit about, you know, community care, I was worried that he might be lost, might be a missing person, was a pretext. But we don't even have to get to that.
Tell me why, as a matter of social policy, we should be worried about that.
Well, we should be worried about that because there's no limitation on what the police officer can do under those circumstances. Anybody could be missing. So then that permits a police officer just to pick out, says anyone they see, anyone walking by, and figure out this person might be missing. Or I might find out later that this person is found dead in a culvert 48 hours later. So I've got to be able to tell that I saw them 48 hours prior to their body being found. Well, I don't know what purpose that serves, but in any event, it's a situation whereby the police officer could ask anyone.
Well, you know, in our situation, as I recall it, we're talking about 4 o'clock in the morning, somebody walking down the median with no apparent direction. It's very cold outside. So forget about the caretaker business for a moment. Why should we limit a police officer asking a very logical question? What are you doing out at 4 o'clock in the morning when it's freezing cold? And the guy answers, and the police officer simply says, well, what's your name, and where are you going? And then he checks his name and his birthday, and asks for his birthday, and then checks it when he gets back in the computer. And let's assume two things, which are probably grounded in reality. That's the kind of contact he may well write up under his administrative rules, for fear that if it's found out later that this person has burglarized a home, broken in, raped someone, or fallen in a ditch and died, the question's going to be asked of him, what's wrong with you? It's 4 o'clock in the morning, freezing to death. Why didn't you do something with this guy? You really let this happen. And all he's done is a momentary questioning, name, birth date, and run it through a computer. Why should we be offended that that's some kind of unreasonable invasion of that person's privacy?
That permits anyone abroad to be detained and questioned in order to ascertain whether there are warrants outstanding for them. and that's impermissible under Delaware law, no matter how temporary the detention is.
It's impermissible because it doesn't. You can't do that without reasonable suspicion, and you can't. And you have to comply with 1902. Is that your position?
Yes. Okay. In order to ask those questions, this would have been an altogether different case if the police officer they had had a report of a missing person, and the missing person report described. Let's say it was a teenage female, approximately 14 years old. Says with an earring, says on the left. Red hair, a rose tattoo on the side of her neck, et cetera. That was the missing person report. And the person encountered at that median fit that description. That's an altogether different situation. What you have here, however, is a situation where a police officer can stop anyone abroad just to find out who they are. Are your papers in order? And that's not permissible, as under Delaware law. This situation, too, under the facts.
And when you say under Delaware law, I want to make sure in my own mind, you're not saying Delaware case law. You're saying it's impermissible because 1902 changed the common law, which would have required probable cause. But when it changed it, it said now there's a lesser standard. That's reasonable suspicion. But that reaffirms that Delaware law has never countenanced just walking up to somebody and asking him for pedigree information for no other reason.
No, I don't believe it has. And to the extent that 1902 permits it, 1902 is not satisfied in this case because there wasn't reasonable and articulable suspicion that crime was afoot.
Well, I think everybody agrees there wasn't reasonable articulable suspicion that he was committing a crime. But the argument is there a way that 1902 doesn't apply to this fact situation because of its particular circumstances? Or should 1902 be read the way you believe it should be read?
Yes, it should be. It doesn't permit a detention under these circumstances to ask those questions. It's a little like factually, it's similar to one of the companion cases, the Sebron.
1902 applies when you have detained and, in effect, seized someone. And the argument here is this person was never detained or seized.
Well,
they were always free to go. They didn't have to answer any questions at all.
We believe that is not correct under Delaware law. And we contend it's not correct under Delaware law for two very important distinctions, which may not be present under other states' law or under the situation that the United States Supreme Court considered in Terry and its progeny. Under Delaware law, under our statute, our resisting arrest statute, a person may resist arrest, may be convicted of resisting arrest for resisting an arrest or detention, even a temporary detention. You may find yourself convicted of resisting arrest for resisting a temporary detention. Not only that, you may be convicted of resisting arrest under the Ellison case, even if the arrest or detention is illegal. So to the extent that it was remarked below, I can tell any police officer, I don't have to answer your questions. My name is Putentain. Ask me again, I'll tell you the same, and just go flying off. Well, that Delaware citizen is subject to, is under that construct that this is not a seizure, is subject to being, to guessing whether he or she will be arrested and charged. At the very least, they're going to be subject to two-hour detention for not answering the questions. Secondly, they face prosecution for resisting a detention, a Class A misdemeanor under Delaware law, even if the attempted detention by the officer was totally illegal.
But I assume you would argue in that case that there's a constitutional right to walk away, so therefore that statute's unconstitutional, right?
We'd argue that, and there's a good chance we'd lose under the Ellison case.
But by that time, the person's got the rest of their life to explain why they were arrested for resisting arrest.
I don't know why anyone would want to be in that position. I don't understand. I'm sorry.
Can we switch over for a moment to the custodial or the caretaker function? Because if I understand you in the facts of this case, you're saying that there was no basis under 1902 to say anything to your client, right? Because there was no suspicion of any criminal activity. Okay, so let's move away from that and say, was there any basis for interaction between the police and your client based upon the police's caretaker function? And I think you would agree that there was, right, under, you know, the time of night and the weather and so forth. So that brings us to the point of, well, what exactly are the police officers allowed to say as part of their caretaker function? And if I understand you, you're saying they can go up to a person and say, are you all right? Do you need any help? Because that obviously is, I'm trying to help you and provide care for you. But that's it. There is no, it is impermissible to also ask, what's your name? Because why?
Because it exceeds the purpose for the original purported, this contact. It's a detention at that point because the person should not believe they can leave because they're subject to two-hour detention thereafter or subject to being charged with resisting arrest for resisting a detention. So in that sense, well, there isn't a problem with whether it's described as the community caretaker function or it's described as not being a seizure with a police officer asking, hey, you know, is everything okay? You know, do you need a ride? Anything like that? No, everything's okay. And under these circumstances, that function, that peril or need was dispelled. No, everything's okay. He gave very descriptive, my car broke down. I'm headed up here to the corner, the service station. My mother's going to meet me there and pick me up. And, you know, in addition to first the stop, the officer described he was heavily layered and clothing was 46 degrees. So,
What if the order were reversed? It's the middle of the night. It's cold out. You're walking on the median of the highway. The police officer comes by. And instead of the first question being, hey, are you all right? Do you need any help? The first question is, hey, what's your name? But the police officer has pulled over and stopped to engage in conversation with this person because of the police officer's concern about his safety on the road and the weather and so forth. Would that be okay?
Depends. That's a different case, but it depends on what facts. Let's say if it develops the facts, hey, what's your name? Says it could be that the police officer honestly thought this guy looked like somebody he played football with in high school, and he hadn't seen him for 15 years. That's a different situation. But under Delaware law, when a police officer asks, what's your name, what's your birthday, what's your address, where are you going to, that should triggers on any person who is knowledgeable and cognizant, we're all cognizant of the law, that the police officer is exercising a function, a law enforcement function, that ordinary citizens don't have under Section 1902. That's not necessarily implicated where a police officer just asks, what's your name? Because the next question may be, I thought we were on the same football team, or I thought we were on the football team. This situation, though, was altogether clear what the purpose of this stop was.
You only have a minute and a half left.
I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal if the court permits, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. My name is Paul Wallace. I'm here on behalf of the State of Delaware. I guess I'd like to take up first the last point that Mr. O'Donnell ended with, and that is this. What the defense, what the appellant wants to say in this case is, if the police ever ask any one of those four questions, it's a seizure. That's it. Delaware law says so. If that's the truth, then I can fold up my folder now and we can leave. But that would leave the police in a position where they could never undertake any of the things that we want them to do.
Well, maybe I misunderstood Mr. O'Donnell's answer to Justice Berger's question, but I thought he said there are circumstances under which it would be all right to ask somebody their name, as if you thought it might be somebody you played football with. But it depended upon how many investigatory questions you asked under what circumstances to put somebody on notice they were being detained. But maybe I misunderstood
it. Well, it seemed to me, Your Honor, that he started there but then ended with the, if you ask any of these four questions, you're implicating 1902. And the problem with that is, where do you draw the lines? And one of the keys in this particular case is this hearing was held before a Superior Court judge, a very experienced Superior Court judge, and that judge made certain credibility decisions related to what the police officer said he was there for and what he was doing. And in fact, I think we've gotten to the point, although sometimes when you read the papers, it seems a little bit different. I think we've gotten to the point that what the police officer was doing in the initial part of this interaction, we have all agreed, was something that was good. Asking a person who looked like they may need some assistance whether they in fact needed some assistance at 3:50 in the morning and under all those circumstances. And that the divergence seems to be when we get to the very last part of that interaction, and that is, what's your name and what's your date of birth?
Well, but isn't there clearly a distinction? I think most people could readily differentiate between even a bunch of questions, maybe a dozen questions that are aimed at your health and well-being by a police officer who comes by versus questions about who you are, how are you identified, what's your social security number, or what's your date of birth, or where do you live. All of those are identifying pieces of information that now it's no longer the police helping out an anonymous individual or attempting to help out one. Now it's the police finding out, who is this person I happen to be having contact with? I'm getting information that has nothing to do with helping the person out.
And maybe that's where we differ, Your Honor, and that is, those questions aren't so grossly divorced from the first part of the interaction. Those questions, and I think the Chief Justice hit it when Mr. O'Donnell was up here, they don't automatically diverge into some investigative type function. He's asked the gentleman, how he's doing, where he's going, all those types of things. And one of the last things he asks him is who he is. The police aren't always carrying out just one specific function, but they do when they have that particular function. At least it should be reasonable for them to understand who it is they dealt with. Because if something happens to him, and I think that Officer Brittingham's tried to allude to that when he was during his testimony, although maybe not as articulately as we wish, and maybe it wasn't drawn out as much as we wish, but he was specifically asked about that by Mr. Robinson. So your reason for stopping was purely to offer assistance. Yes, sir. How was the name and date of birth related to your offer of assistance? And he said, we usually do that in case if anything happens to him. We have got some place, we know this person, we have some point of reference for him. Because if, in fact, he was...
Okay. I think we can all understand the idea that you want to have some administrative record of, I made contact with this person in the middle of the night to see if he was okay. He said he was okay. This person was Tom Jones. And here's where he told me he lives. But what we also all know is that having gotten that information, the police officer didn't just put it in the file for writing up his report later when he got back to the police station. He ran a computer check to see whether maybe he got a live one. And that's the problem.
But that same computer check is the same computer check that would have told him if he was a missing person or if, in fact, he was wanted or if he's a runaway or whatever.
Or
that's
a mental patient
or something like that. That's the problem, Your Honor. I mean, he has to go to that computer. He enters that name, and any number of things can come up, some of which are helpful to the citizen if, in fact, he is a mental patient who is,
So what you're saying, if I understand your position correctly, Mr. Walvis, is that the scope of questions that are permissible under 1902 and the scope of questions that are permissible under the caretaker doctrine are not hermetically sealed tight compartments that never intersect.
Absolutely
the
not.
Questions can flow into each other for perfectly permissible purposes. Is
and
that
it
right?
It truly depends on the factual circumstance. And I think that's what the community caretaker doctrine is all about.
But and if there's an abuse, then the control is what? The credibility determination by the judge?
I believe that is, just as it is in any other factual circumstance where the court has to determine whether or not the objective factors known to the police are such that a reasonable police officer in that situation would have taken that action. And I think that the judge in this case did make that credibility determination.
If I'm not misunderstanding you, what you're advocating would result in a blanket authority for the police to always ask a person for their name, date of birth, and address in any encounter. Because, after all, if they've got 1902 basis to stop the person, then they're entitled to ask those questions. And if it's not 1902 and it's a caretaker type of situation, then they still can ask those questions because it might be helpful, might not, but it might be helpful. So although you're talking about, you know, case-by-case basis, I'm having a tough time understanding when, under your view, the police would not be authorized to ask for the pedigree information.
When it has no rational basis to what they're talking about or what is going on at that time, Your Honor.
But at the very least, they would need it so that they could write a report about who they just talked to.
They would at least most likely need a name. That's true. But I think the Montana Supreme Court is helpful here, and I think that the three-part test that they came up with in 2002 is helpful to this court if, in fact, the community caretaker doctrine is what this court wishes to place this particular activity in, and I think it does. I think it falls squarely in it because it talks about how rational and how reasonable what the police officer does. And I would suggest under the factual circumstances it was occurring there on October 13th in that early morning that it simply was a very rational thing for the police officer to ask that name and to even run it to for the reasons that he stated. The court is correct. Most likely when the police officer come in contact with people, there probably is some rational basis to at least ask them their name. Sometimes it's just to be polite. It's not unusual for the police officers to try to have a personal connection with the person when they first came up to him. He may have gone up to Mr. Williams at first and said, "Sir, what's your name?" And he says, "Jordan Williams." And then, just like most people who deal with the public, what does he do? He starts to use his name. Why? Because it lowers the tensions and it builds a relationship between somebody when you actually are dealing with them. Many of us do that who have to deal with the public all the time. So that wouldn't be an unusual circumstance.
Well, let's assume that that makes perfect sense as a matter of good social policy, and the community caretaker doctrine ought to be the law, and the three parameters that the Montana Supreme Court has drawn are the most perfectly logical way to implement it. We still know what Rickard said. You couldn't stop and ask people, detain them, ask the questions unless you had probable cause, which was then the common law. Apparently no community caretaker doctrine existed at that time. We know that 1902 was a declaration by the legislature that we're going to ease the police officer's pain, make it easier for them to ask four logical questions. What's your name? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? What is your business abroad? When there's a reasonable articulable suspicion to detain them and ask those questions. That's the General Assembly telling us what police officers can do under reasonable articulable suspicion. That abrogated the common law. Are you now telling us that we can deviate from 1902's restrictions and create a common law doctrine even easier than that for the purpose of asking certain questions under certain circumstances within parameters that we can draw at common law, even in the face of 1902?
No, Your Honor, and here's why.
Where does it come from then?
I would like to first respectfully disagree with both the court and the defense in this case that we know that Rickard says that you could never speak to somebody and talk to them. What Rickard says, and if you really read Rickard's, what it says is an arrest had to be based on probable cause. if you look at the facts and records, what happened was they did a full custodial arrest. They just picked this guy up out of the, basically out of the woods, and took him in and held him, didn't comply with any of the statutory functions that were needed under then existing law, 5173 or 5683, didn't take him before a magistrate, didn't do any of those types of things. It does not speak at all about those lesser forms of intrusion or seizures that 1902 looks to address and that the Uniform Arrest Act in Section 2 looked to address. That was the problem in 1951. The problem was, where are you between a full custodial arrest and basically what may be a consensual discussion between a citizen and a police officer? Where are you? What is the basis for which a police officer may be able to detain somebody in between there to do questioning or interrogation? That's what it did. Rickards doesn't speak to that at all, Your Honor, and I suggest there's a great gross over reading of Rickards.
Read Rickards, I'll really read it and not just read it, as you have recommended to me. Put that aside for a moment. 1902 stepped into the gap between the consensual contact and the probable cause for arrest, okay? And it did so by statute. Why do we step in and create a caretaker doctrine at common law?
Because what it deals with are non-seizures. This was not a seizure or a detention. That's what 1902 governs, seizures, actual Fourth Amendment seizures. This was not that. This was not a detention. If you look at all of the factual circumstances of what occurred, this is much more akin to something like Ross or those other circumstances.
I understand that, but my point is, why don't we leave it to the legislature? Why do we create a common law doctrine to cover this situation?
Well, I don't believe that there necessarily needs to be a common law doctrine, because common law didn't prohibit police officers from having contact with folks that weren't seizures or detentions. And I would suggest that the best reading of the community caretaker doctrine is they're not seizures. They're explanations of why police officers may in fact have these types of interactions that seem quasi-official, because maybe it's just good sense, maybe it's just good.
And what are the limitations on the exercise of the community caretaker role?
Well, I would suggest that the Montana Supreme Court's limitations are pretty well drawn, and I think that Virginia in Commonwealth versus Waters discussed it also. Basically, you have to objectively determine the reasonableness of what the police officer is doing. I believe it was Oregon, one of the other states, I can't remember if it's Oregon or Oklahoma right now, that actually gives a statutory definition of what the caretaker role is that's mentioned in the briefing. But I think that the three steps or the three phases that the Montana Supreme Court talks about, first of all, looking and seeing that there are objective and articulable facts that one, an experienced police officer, would believe that, in fact, the person may need help or may be in peril.
What about the cases when there is a seizure? I mean, President Judge Vaughn wrote about it, the doctrine, where a car pulled up, turned on the red lights, the man's head was out the window, he determined it was a seizure, right?
Right.
So how do we interplay 1902 in that circumstance?
Well, I did not do the first oral argument in this case. Ms. Adams did, but I did sit through it because I had another case that had similar issues. And I remember, in fact, Your Honor asking that very question, is which is the better view of this, that it is, in fact, a seizure, or it is in fact, a seizure that's excused, or that it's not a seizure at all? And the proper answer to that question is, I'm not quite sure. There are good and telling reasons to address both. For instance, in this case, I would suggest respectfully that it is best to view it as not even a seizure, given the nature of the interaction and things like that. It's much more like a Ross-type situation where this court has found it wasn't a seizure.
Well, let's go back to the Chief Justice's question. You indicated some states have recognized the caretaker doctrine as a matter of common law. Others, apparently Oregon, have done it by statute. Why should we choose the common law?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that because if we attempt to do it, if we say we have to leave this simply to the legislature, what we're asking them to do, and I think it's a very difficult thing to do, is try to define in some type of way what are all non-seizures. And that's a very difficult thing to do because seizures really are, in fact, one, very fact-specific, two, what in fact entails a seizure now is a product of hundreds of years of case law. What we would be asking the legislature to do is define for us what non-seizures are, when the police officers can talk to anybody other times, and what they can do. The problem is that given the number of factual circumstances, and there's a rather long string cite by the state in our supplemental memorandum that talks about many of the different types of caretaker or non-law enforcement or investigative police roles that the police take, everything from material spills to, as this court has addressed sometimes, babies that seem to be in distress in an apartment, to a person walking down the street, to a lost child, to whatever. The real question, and I'd suggest the real best way to deal with it, is in fact in the adoption of a Montana-type structure for people to deal with.
But what you're saying is if, however we define it, you're exercising your community caretaker role, you're always allowed to ask the person their name and date of birth and then run it through the police data bank.
I would suggest that it is almost always going to be rationally related to every caretaker role. Let's say, for instance, a material spill. You don't need to know the person's name. You need to tell them you need to get out of there and move over to here. Probably asking the question and asking them their name and things like that and running it through the computer doesn't much matter there. This was a much different factual circumstance. But, yes, I would suggest probably in many of those instances that are set forth in where a community caretaker role has been addressed by courts, there's probably going to be some rational basis for the police officer to at least ask the person their name. And yes, is it permissible then, if the police officer has their name, to run it through the computer? Yeah, it is. Well, that's one pool.
If there's a rational basis for the police officer to ask these questions under certain objective circumstances, if you really read 1902, isn't the legislature saying you can ask these four questions when you have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that somebody has, is, or is about to commit a crime? Are they sending any message to us about any common law doctrine that we may craft that says, but there are other circumstances, despite that statutory statement, under which you can ask two of the four or three of the four that the legislature has justified arguably when and arguably only when there's a reasonable articulable suspicion to detain someone and ask those questions? How do we satisfy ourselves that we're not infringing on the legislative prerogative by saying we're going to tell people when there are other circumstances in addition to the existence of reasonable articulable suspicion when the police can stop you and ask you those questions?
Because I believe that what 1902 does is tell the police when they may demand those, and they may in fact enforce them by a two-hour detention to continue on. It does not take the place of every other interaction or really speak to every other interaction between police and citizenry. And those, I believe, are the operative words there. What it says is when you have reasonable articulable suspicion that somebody is involved in criminality, you can stop them, and you may demand that they answer these four questions. And if they don't, you can keep them for 2 hours to decide what you're going to do with them. And only in those circumstances may you do that. But it doesn't say you can't ask a person their name or address or anything else in other circumstances. And I think that's the real difference there. because the other interactions that police are going to engage in are going to call upon sometimes those questions being asked. If a kid's lost, you're going to ask them their address, or a teenager or whomever that person was on the median that Mr. O'Donnell had, the 14-year-old with tattoos and things like that, that he mentioned. There are simply going to be those circumstances where those questions come up in other contexts.
All right. Well, that makes a lot of logical sense, and I'm sure we'll all have to think about that. What about Mr. O'Donnell's point that if you were, for example, detained as Mr. Williams was, and you leave, and then the police officer goes back to the computer, finds out that there's a warrant for you, under what circumstances could the police officer claim that by asking those questions, he had detained you, he had seized you and detained you until he did his computer check, and when you walked away, you in effect resisted arrest? How do we guard against that in any way of crafting this caretaker doctrine?
Well, Your Honor, I'd suggest respectfully that just wasn't a detention period. In fact, in this factual circumstance, it wasn't a detention or a seizure. And it's the same, I would suggest respectfully, it's the same test this court uses all the time to determine whether a Fourth Amendment seizure has occurred.
Okay, what if the police officer said to Mr. Williams, and I'm going to borrow from Justice Holland's practice and ask you a hypothetical, and to which you don't
and
respond.
And I will really listen.
to which you don't respond, well, that isn't this case. And then I can say it isn't because it's a hypothetical. What if the police officer said, wait here until I run your name through the computer, and the person left? Where are we there?
Is that a detention for which the person could be subjected to resisting arrest?
Yeah. Is that a detention when he says, wait here until I run your name and address through the computer? I want to find out whether you're an escaped mental patient or whether there's a warrant for your arrest. Or he doesn't even say that. Doesn't alert the person that he's checking him out. Is that okay?
I think that at that point, when the police officer then is showing his authority and really curtailing the person's liberty by his show of authority, that you are much closer to what is a seizure. And I think that's Jones.
Well, but is that a seizure? I agree it's much closer. I think we'd all agree on that.
Likely it is, yeah. I suggest it probably is, because I think this court's case law in Jones would say so. Now, it might depend on how he asked him, too. What if he explained to him, look, I just want to check you out. Do you mind waiting here for a moment? Then maybe it isn't. But I think that if he is, by the force of his authority, saying, you must stay here, I think you are most likely in a detention or a seizure situation. By the way, that's not this case. What happened was he let Mr. Williams go. And I think that goes directly to the fact that the police officer was doing exactly what he told the court below he was doing. And that was he let Mr. Williams go, and then only then did he check on the computer and realized that, in fact, he was wanted. So,
thank you very much. And thanks for being a good sport about it.
For purposes of Section 1902 and the practicalities of this situation, I disagree with Mr. Wallace in that the officer didn't let him go. The man walked on, but had there been altogether different circumstances, let's say the man was about to board a DART bus, I think he would have been detained, says at that point.
How do you respond to Mr. Wallace's interpretation of 1902, which is to the effect that the police can always answer these four questions, but 1902 puts some teeth in it if they have a reasonable, articulable suspicion, and if you don't get the answers, you can keep them for 2 hours. But 1902 doesn't prevent you from asking the questions. You just can't act on them, so to speak, without a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
The problem with that is that whether a seizure occurs depends upon the perception of a reasonable person under those circumstances. And under those circumstances, when you're asked those questions and you realize that under Delaware law, a police officer can exercise that function to detain you, and you are subject to arrest if you exercise your rights when the officer didn't have probable cause to detain you, that's a situation where it's just simply not as permissible. In addition, I could walk outside today and I could be perspiring under the premise that the state puts before the court. I could be perspiring. I could be stopped by a Dover's police officer perspiring. Are you okay, buddy? I think the court understands my example.
I'd like to ask final question. Do you think if we made a list of all the states which have the community care doctrine and the states which have the Uniform Arrest Act, which has 1902-like provisions in it, that we'd find an intersection where there are states that have both?
To some extent, there's possibly... It's hard to identify which courts or which states really have a community caretaker function because, as I've discussed before, there's a little bit of labeling. Some of the situations, the factual situations where they say this is a community caretaker function, there really wasn't a seizure to begin with. So I don't think there'd necessarily be a correlation.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.